This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hi, this is Valerie Goldston. Today I'll be reading to you from Reader's Digest. Words to Live by Josie Glausius. In the early hours of March 23rd, 2023, about 12 hours before our treasured 12-year-old son died from a rare form of brain cancer, I climbed into his bed at Sher Zedek Medical Center in Jerusalem, and wrapped him in my arms and recited the poem Jabberwocky. 'Twas brilling, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. My child was no longer conscious, but I hoped and believed that he could sense my presence and that my voice would comfort him and soothe his furiously beating heart. My son had learned the words to Lewis Carroll's nonsense poem by listening to me recite it to him and his twin sister at bedtime. A brave, bright, imaginative, optimistic boy, he loved the drama of the poem and the courage of the beamish boy, as with his vorpal sword in hand he defeats his maximum foe. My son was also a passionate reader, but toward the end of a year punctuated by surgeries, rounds of radiation, hospitalizations, and medications, it was harder for him to focus. Instead, I would sit beside his hospital bed and read aloud to him, mostly Richmal Crompton's Just William stories. One evening in the hospital in mid-February, I read him some of my favorite poems, poems that my mother had read to me as a child. Cargoes by John Masefield, Quinquirium of Nivea from Distant Orphir, Rowing Home to Heaven in Sunny Palestine, and a Shakespeare sonnet, When in Disgrace from Fortune and Men's Eyes. He listened, rapt and smiling. Then we talked about the meaning of the poems. A few days later, I started my own poetry group on WhatsApp, calling it Poetry is Medicine, and invited friends to join. I had found during earlier crises that the rhythm of poetry can soothe my anxiety. With just a word or a phrase, a poem can reach the hidden places that prayers or well-meaning advice cannot. The poems offered an anchor to me during unpredictable and painful times. In a calm interlude each day, I searched in my anthologies and on sites such as Poetry Daily for the right poem to share. The right poem could be about almost anything, an apple tree, an insect, a pie, a miracle. Some were classics, Everyone Sang by Siegfried Sassoon, A Modest Love by Sir Edward Dyer, The Lowest Trees Have Tops, The Ant Her Gall. One, a psalm, The Lord to Me a Shepherd Is, Want Therefore Shall I Not. People responded with heart emojis and their own favorites. My mother shared Shakespeare soliloquies. We had to learn chunks by heart, she wrote. My sister and I exchanged messages about the poems of R.S. Thomas, which we had studied in school, recalling one that begins, All right, I was Welsh. Does it matter? Friends contributed. One sent Chinese Foot Chart by K. Ryan. Look, boats of mercy embark from our hearts at the oddest knock. Another friend carefully translated the Hebrew poem Apple of Imperfection by Varda Genisar. First speech is the speech of love. Last speech, silence. The poems took on a life of their own. Friends shared them with their friends, saying that the verses added joy to their day. The poems that you send express in words feelings that I have no ability to express, my friend Marilyn wrote. One old school friend bought new collections, telling me, It's been years, actually decades, since I've read poetry, but you have rekindled an interest. On 9:22 a.m. on March 23, 2023, I shared the poem Jabberwocky with my WhatsApp group. My son's heart stopped beating 3.5 hours later as I held his hand and sang to him. In our family, my husband, our daughter, Their loss is a catastrophe. The space that our son filled with his loving nature, his exuberance, his magical smile, his luminous observations, and his laughter was replaced by a gigantic empty hole. I stopped posting poems. When my friend Layla sent me Late Fragment, Raymond Carver's last published poem, and what did we want? To call ourselves beloved, to feel myself beloved on the earth. It offered me some small comfort, because I knew that even in my son's darkest hours, he was always loved, and still is, and was never for a moment alone. I shared Late Fragment with my poetry group, and I began again to share poems and songs. One was Taken Care by Calista Buchan. I sit with my grief. I mother it. I hold its small, hot hand. I don't say shh. Another was Theme in Yellow. The title contains my son's favorite cheerful color, by Carl Sandburg. When dusk has fallen, children join hands and circle around me, singing ghost songs. Friends posted yellow heart emojis. They added comments, quoted favorite lines. I felt loved and supported, and I was able to get up in the morning and take care of my daughter, who has lost her twin and only sibling, from whom she had never been apart. 7 weeks before my son died, we had celebrated our daughter's bat mitzvah. In synagogue, she read beautifully from the Torah portion of Beshalach, in which the Israelites, fleeing slavery in Egypt, crossed the Red Sea on dry land, as the waters formed a wall for them on their right hand and on their left. Itself a beautiful poem, it reflected my feelings, that our community has formed strong walls around us, supporting us at every step of our grueling journey. Perhaps that's why the poem that is most meaningful to me is Moises, or Moses, by Luis Alberto de Cunica, translated from Spanish by Gustavo Perez Fermet. On the 8th day after my son died, I read it aloud beside his grave. Give me your hand. We have to cross the river, and my strength fails me. Hold me as if I were an abandoned package in a wicker basket, a lump that moves and cries in the twilight. Cross the river with me, even if this time the waters don't part before us. Even if this time God doesn't come to our aid and a flurry of arrows riddles our backs, even if there is no river. Here's some humor. All in a day's work. I was doing research for an article I was writing about how kids can learn about insects. Wondering who I might interview, I told my husband, I need to find an entomologist. He just shook his head. What's wrong now? You're always going to the doctor for one thing or the other. Julie Engelhart, Prospect, Kentucky. A couple came into our vision center with their playful old English sheepdog, which kept demanding attention from me. So I leaned over and cooed in its face. Hello, Misty. It is not Misty, her owner snapped. Oh, I'm sorry, I said. I thought I'd heard you call her Misty. She then set me straight. Her name is Misty Rose. Gina Milazzo, Staten Island, New York. Passive-aggressive flattery on the job, as shared on Reddit. It's impressive how you manage to stay so confident. You continue to meet expectations. I will give your suggestion all the consideration that it deserves. I'm certain you tried your best. My husband was on patrol when his police radio crackled. It was from dispatch advising that a large naked male wearing a turban was running in and out of traffic, threatening drivers and pedestrians with a sword. With tongue firmly in cheek, my husband replied, Dispatch, do you have a color on that turban? Chris Lepore, Hayward, California. Terrifying watershed moment at work. For years, kids have accidentally called teachers mom or dad. Today, one of my colleagues got referred to as Alexa. Tim Paramore. The bar where I worked was in a rough neighborhood, so when a new bartender had to close alone, she understandably didn't want to leave the cash in the till. But since our boss had neglected to tell her where to stow it overnight, she placed the money in a bag and stuck it where no thief would find it. Concerned that the morning shift wouldn't find it either, she left this note on the cash register. Money bag is in the ice machine. Robert Wood, Melrose, Iowa. I was sitting in on a Zoom meeting when I received a message from the host. While I appreciate you staying muted, we can see exactly what you're thinking based on your facial expressions. I'm going to have to ask you to turn off your video as well. Thank you. Laura Ann, STL. Taking a lazy day. An estimated 745,000 deaths worldwide are attributed to work-related stress. These people have no need to worry. Last June, a man stormed into a gas station in Tulsa, Oklahoma, demanding all the money or he'd shoot up the joint. The clerk readily handed over the loot. He then closed shop and left. According to radio station WABF in Baton Rouge, since he'd hired the man to rob the gas station. Turns out he was tired and wanted to go home early. Three figurines, a painting on display in a Russian museum in 2022, featured three forms with blank faces. A bored museum guard knew how to bide his time. Using a ballpoint pen, he drew eyes on two of the figures. It was, says CNET, his first and last day on the job. An Italian court upheld a school's right to fire Cinzia Polina De Leo, a teacher for 24 years, after it was learned that for 20 of those years, she simply never showed up for work. De Leo insists that she has documents proving she had a reason for missing work. Unfortunately, she told the newspaper, La Repubblica, she couldn't produce them quite yet, saying, "Right now I'm at the beach." Our next story, Pet Heroes, by Dave Wedge from Boston Magazine. Bill Cushing was exercising in his home gym when he got the call. It was a little before 1 p.m. on June 4th, 2021, and the Braintree, Massachusetts police officer thought he could get a workout in before his shift started. When Cushing suddenly heard sirens, though, and his phone lit up with the Braintree Police Department number, he knew his day was about to start early. A domestic violence call had come in, and the department needed Cushing and Kit, his police dog for the past decade, to help find the suspect. Cushing rushed to put on his uniform. Kit, an 11-year-old German Shepherd Belgian Malinois mix, snapped to attention. It was time to go to work. Cushing drove toward the scene on McCuster Drive, listening to the radio chatter and speeding up as he heard the action escalate. The suspect probably had two firearms, was on foot, and had fled into the woods behind a massive apartment complex. Cushing knew the spot. Those woods had been the site of many police incidents where he and Kit had tracked assailants in the past. By the time Cushing whipped into the parking lot at the edge of the woods, other officers were there. One directed Cushing and Kit to the last known spot where the fugitive had been seen. Kit immediately picked up the scent, and they were off, charging into the brush. Kit tugged forcefully at his leash, almost dragging Cushing into a sprint. Soon, Kit leaped toward a large rock, which let Cushing know that behind it, the armed man they were after was hiding and ready to pounce. 10 years earlier, on a warm July day in 2011, Cushing climbed into a van with Mark O'Reilly, the master canine trainer from the Massachusetts Department of Correction. They headed toward a police dog training center in Bethany, Connecticut. Cushing didn't yet know much about being a canine officer. He'd been a beat cop for the past 6 years. But now, in his early 30s, he wanted more action and to make a greater contribution to keeping his hometown safe. He believed that becoming a canine officer was the way to do it. Not every cop can become a canine officer. Candidates need to be hardworking, incredibly fit, and most of all, catch the attention of the police chief. Once officers are selected, they must undergo hundreds of hours of specialized training before getting to work with a dog. It's an elite circle. At the training facility, Cushing and O'Reilly emerge from their vehicle to a chorus of dogs barking inside the long white building. One of the facility's trainers came out with a dog for their inspection. His name was Kit. Kit was a mangy-looking dog with matted hair, long pointy ears that stood straight up, and a funny look in his eye. Cushing didn't like what he saw. O'Reilly, though, wasn't paying attention to Kit's looks, but to the way he strode out of his kennel as though he belonged. He was just 11 months old and hadn't been trained to track scents, yet he immediately spotted a 5-gallon bucket with some toys in it. He attacked the bucket with a vengeance, toppling it over and thrashing it around. "We'll take him," O'Reilly said. "Aw, geez," Cushing thought. Now this funny-looking dog with no tracking experience was coming home with him. The next 16 weeks served as a boot camp for Cushing and Kit. Each morning, the pair headed out for intensive 8 to 12-hour training sessions, tracking through vast fields, empty buildings, and surrounding forests. O'Reilly told Cushing that he had to learn to trust his dog, even when Cushing had his doubts. Still, the most important part of the training took place at home. Cushing learned that for their partnership to be successful, Kit needed to believe that Cushing was the only person who would provide him with food and water, and that his own survival depended on Cushing's safety. So, for the first few weeks, Cushing fed Kit only by hand. He would serve him a water bowl, and if Kit didn't drink, he would remove it. Cushing became everything to Kit. It was mutual. Cushing didn't have a wife, girlfriend, or children. Kit was the focus of his profession, his home life, and his affection. About halfway through their training, Cushing and Kit went to the prison complex for a long, challenging tracking test. A trainer posing as a suspect, clad in a protective bite suit, hid hundreds of yards away. Kit picked up his scent and aggressively pursued. When he spotted the trainer, Kit leaped at him, flying 10 feet through the air and nearly knocking him down to the ground. "Whoa," Cushing thought, "this dog actually works." "Congratulations," O'Reilly told Cushing. "You are cleared hot," which means that Kit was ready to hit the streets. Kit and Cushing's first assignment was to track a bank robber. Kit picked up a scent at the bank and led Cushing down the road, where they discovered some cash that the robber had dumped before fleeing in a getaway car. Kit's discovery helped other officers pick up the trail and capture the robber. Many successful assignments followed. Sometimes, when the tracks were long and grueling, Cushing wondered if Kit was still on the scent. Then he would hear O'Reilly's voice in his head, "Trust your dog." So Cushing did, and Kit never let him down. Cushing soon grew to rely on Kit in other ways, too. If Cushing had a personal problem, he talked to Kit about it. If Cushing was having a rough day, Kit would intuitively rest his head on him. Before Cushing knew it, Kit wasn't just his partner. They were best friends. In the early hours of a March day in 2016, Cushing was asleep when his phone rang. It was his lieutenant. A man had allegedly threatened the mother of his 2 children and was on the loose, drunk, and carrying a knife. "We need you and Kit to find this guy," the lieutenant ordered. Kit was already up and standing at attention. He seemed to sense that they were going to work. Kit barked as they drove, with sirens screaming and lights flashing, toward the neighborhood where the suspect had last been seen. When they arrived, Kit picked up the scent of his target, 44-year-old Robert Dussard. Kit then led Cushing and other officers through several backyards and onto a street where Kit stopped and attempted to dive under a parked car. The officers then knew that was where the man they were after was hiding. Cushing gripped Kit's leash in his left hand, shining his flashlight underneath the vehicle to see the fugitive. The round beam of light passed over Dussard's face. "Come out, man," Cushing said to Dussard. Silence. "Hey, buddy, I don't want my dog to bite you," Cushing added. "Just come out. Give up." Kit sat still, riveted, waiting for Cushing's command to pounce. Then Dussard poked his head up from under the car and looked directly at him. Dussard allegedly said, "I'm going to kill you." An instant later, the suspect darted out from under the car, pulled a large kitchen knife out of his pants, and advanced toward Cushing and Kit. "Drop the knife," Cushing recalls yelling. "My dog's going to bite you." Dussard kept moving toward them, leaving Cushing no choice. He released his grip on the leash. Kit leaped through the air and sank his teeth into the suspect's right hip. Dussard wailed and began flailing his knife. Cushing was terrified that he would stab Kit. Enraged, Dussard advanced, stabbing at the air, just inches from Cushing. Cushing sensed it was a shoot-or-be-killed situation, but feared he might strike Kit while trying to hit the suspect. He fired two quick rounds and Dussard fell to the ground, with Kit still biting him. Cushing rushed over and grabbed Kit around the neck to release his bite. Other officers immediately attempted CPR on Dussard, but it was too late. Dussard later died at the hospital.